Good morning. So when we were putting these titles together for the program, we were told to, you know, do something Idaho-like. So there's potatoes on the program and stuff like that. Agriculture obviously is important in Idaho, so that's where this comes from. And so while we are hoping that you're all going to be shovel-ready for RCKMS, we realize that at least a few of you in the audience are going to dig in a different way. And for this presentation, I'm sort of taking off my RCKMS co-lead hat and putting on my jurisdiction hat and trying to think about what it's going to actually mean on the ground to have to do this. And outside of a pilot context, outside of, you know, Digital Bridge or other sort of experimental forays. So we've been saying the time is now for a really long time, since 2012. And that's, you know, Janet said, aren't you done yet? I mean, really, you guys. So we're getting closer, and it is now time for all of you and me to, as a representative from Washington State, to think about how we're going to find our way to using this new tooling. The first thing we have to think about, obviously, and we started talking about that yesterday and some this morning, is how does your framework, the public health framework legally in your jurisdiction, affect your use of RCKMS? And in particular, you know, is your jurisdiction even allowed to use RCKMS? And some of you may be saying, allowed? Who's going to tell me no? But I think this is particularly relevant for the discussion of RCKMS as a service, the centralized EICR routing and determination of reportability. We certainly heard when we were talking about ELR that some jurisdictions have a little problem with intermediaries and maybe they want to do things directly. And so, again, if you were in the audience yesterday, you know that even if you need to receive case reports directly, doesn't mean that RCKMS is irrelevant to you. But it may mean that RCKMS as a service, a central service operated on the Ames platform, is not relevant to you. So one of the decisions you're going to need to make is, are you going to use RCKMS to support case reporting, lab reporting, or both? In our current focus on case reporting, we often overlook the fact that RCKMS includes both the logic and the knowledge to support lab reporting, and certainly our partners in places like LabCorp and Mayo and Quest are thrilled that we may finally have all of our laboratory reporting specifications in one place that they can just pull that information from and not have to keep generating it themselves, because they do that. We all know that all of the large laboratory systems maintain our reporting criteria for the entire nation, and they do it four times over, five times over, however many times. This will be a way that they can reduce that burden. Some other decisions for each use case, case reporting, ELR, how will you use RCKMS? Again, are you going to use it only as a knowledge repository to provide information to reporters in human-readable and machine-processable form, or are you also going to use it to provide centralized automated decision support? That doesn't just mean necessarily on the Ames Hub. We've heard at least one of the Digital Bridge implementations is sort of doing a variant on that, and there would be no reason why you couldn't implement decision support at a different level, say, in your state or jurisdiction, using the foundation that RCKMS provides. And again, this is the knowledge repository, and the other is, never mind, the decision support. Next thing, determine when you can start, because there's some prep work that you got to do. We don't have good time counts of how long does it take a jurisdiction to author a set of rules, a simple set. I mean, obviously, if you're just going to accept the default criteria, it's pretty quick. You got to put in some of that other information that folks talked about, like, you know, does it apply to providers or laboratories? Is it when the patient is a resident or when care is provided? That goes pretty fast. I've had my hands on the tool, so I'm doing it from experience. But if you're really going to start to pick and choose and say, yeah, these are the default criteria, but now I want to do X, Y, and Z optional criteria on top, then that starts to become A, more time-consuming, and B, have to require more thought and more review within your own jurisdiction. So when you get through all of that, when can you get through all of that to start? You're going to want to define the impact of RCKMS on your existing processes, including your workflows for things like onboarding, lab reporting, if you're going to use it to support that, and ongoing quality assurance. Again, as you start authoring criteria which tell your reporters what to do, and then you're seeing the results back, seeing how that's going to influence the feedback cycle. And on surveillance and public health action, obviously, as you tweak your criteria, you may need to have some changes in your surveillance system to accommodate some of the changing information. Communication, you've heard about conversations about us communicating out about RCKMS, but clearly you're going to need to communicate to the reporters in your jurisdiction. And with your colleagues, both within your agency, we talked about that yesterday, about, you know, does anybody up from your surveillance or your informatics level even know that this is happening and what the impact might be, and outside of the agency, so your partners in other public health agencies, particularly if you're a jurisdiction where you receive reports and then distribute them out, as many states do. Who are you going to get to fill the shoes? And we didn't talk about it in detail, but you've heard in other presentations about RCKMS authoring. We've got a full authoring life cycle. So we can, you know, draft criteria, review criteria, approve criteria, revise criteria, inactivate criteria, so that and reporting specifications. So there's a whole life cycle that you guys are going to need to support. So is that all going to be one person? Probably not very likely. And you're going to have to figure out in your jurisdiction who is going to do the work, the actual lay the hands on the keyboard work, for each of the sets of conditions. So that means staff resources, and you're going to need to identify the appropriate staff, get them trained through RCKMS trainings, and ensure their availability for the initial content creation, which is the, you know, that's the big lift at the very start. But then, you know, it's not a one and done, because you're going to need to have those same people or people like them available for ongoing maintenance of content, either when your specifications change or when national specifications change. So CST position statements get voted on. The change that those changes get reflected in RCKMS content. What does that mean for you? So obviously the big deal, you dig in, you author, and then you maintain your jurisdictional reporting criteria in the tool. For me, one of the toughest questions from a, you know, wearing my jurisdictional hat is, if the RCKMS content isn't an exact match to your rules, what do you do then? And you heard Catherine say that RCKMS can contain the human readable information, contains some human readable information. So we can make the statements that your rules make, and we can include them, but we can't necessarily include them as computable. And if important aspects of your reporting specifications are not computable and they're not represented that way in RCKMS, what does that mean for you and for reporting in your jurisdiction? It's a pain point. I mean, serious pain point. And you're going to have to answer the question of what are you going to do when there's not that perfect match? And Catherine talked a little bit about that, but I'll just reiterate, some stuff's easy. You know, if you want all blood tests, not just the elevateds, we can do that. If you want positive IgMs and not IgAs, IgGs, we can do that. If you want an age criterion, like in Washington State, we only require reporting of H-flu if the patient is under 5, we can do that. If you want hepatitis B surface antigen positive results in pregnant women, now we're pushing the boundary a little bit, because we know that, you know, we haven't yet fully solved the problem of determining pregnancy status from an electronic case report. These are all examples from Washington State's rules, by the way. If we want animal bites when human exposure to rabies is suspected, that's going to be hard from a case report right now. And finally, we get to, you know, herpes simplex initial infection only, which, whatever you think of this as a reportable condition, is not an ICD code. I mean, there's no ICD 9 or 10 or easy SNOMED code that we can reach in and grab this out of the EHR. So what am I going to do with this in RCKMS? And then there's a new opportunity. So those of you who have been following reportability response know that now we can also create, maintain information to be provided back to reporters in the EICR response. And we had initially planned to maintain some information in RCKMS that could be provided back to reporters, but we have in this reportability response specification that you can hear about later on today, we've got a lot more opportunity. So you can get as detailed as specific recommendations to the provider based on what came to us for the case report, providing a link to a form to collect supplemental information, the sort of structured data capture, but, you know, we're not, it's not really a full-blown implementation of that yet, but in that direction, you can at least give them a link in the reportability response that they can click on, bring up a form on your website, fill it out, or in your portal. What we've always had is links to URLs so that those could be provided back to providers. So that's sort of the minimum is, you know, here's where you go if you want more information. But the direction of the reportability response is clearly much greater specificity, much more close to clinical decision support back to the provider. The old slogan about a man with one watch knows what time it is, a man with two watches is never sure. You're going to need to figure out how to structure the relationships between what's in RCKMS and all of your other existing methods of presenting your jurisdictional criteria, your websites, your posters, you know, God knows your ring binders, whatever. There will be content that will be sitting out there in a tool that is purporting to be an authoritative representation of your criteria. And then what else do you have out there? And how do you tell reporters about how to navigate those different sources? And that leads me to the communication plan, which is how are reporting processes going to change when you start using RCKMS, and how are you going to tell your reporters about them? It's the same question. If your RCKMS content is not an exact match to your rules, again, what do you do then? What do you tell your reporters to do then? This, to me, is one of the most difficult things to think about from a jurisdictional perspective, is how do you communicate this issue in a way that makes sense to reporters and doesn't just make them throw up their hands and say, you're just making it worse, man. Participating in RCKMS is a commitment. And what if you are commitment phobic? So does your jurisdiction have to use RCKMS? I'll let you think about that for a second. I see some parallels. I see particularly a parallel with SRCA, the State Reportable Conditions Assessment, which CST has been doing for quite a while now. And it's a high priority activity for CST. It's not mandatory, but you do get a lot of reminders about it if you don't fill out the survey. And we don't know whether reporters actually use that. I certainly have had conversations with some of the multi-jurisdictional reporters, like large laboratories, where they tell me that they have gone into SRCA. Of course, it's been in a sort of difficult position for the last couple of years. You know, it was a while when we didn't really have updated information on the website. So I think people have probably fallen, even if they were using it before, the use has probably fallen off. So if you think about RCKMS, which has very similar information, but more so, to SRCA, certainly has all the reportability information, if CSTE approaches it the same way, it would be a high priority activity. It would be something that our jurisdictions would get pressured to do. It would not be mandatory, although the emergence of questions on our ELC about whether you've authored your criteria in RCKMS, you all saw that this year, increasing the pressure for all of us to participate. But again, I don't think that there's a way that a law could be written that would say every jurisdiction has to do it. And we're hoping that the reporter use of RCKMS would be higher, even if, again, what they're doing is obtaining human-readable specifications or getting the machine-processable content out of RCKMS and then using it in their own systems, which is what the large labs like Mayo, Quest, and LabCorp have all told us they intend to do. So what happens if you opt out? I mean, you just say, okay, yeah, I know everybody wants me to do this. I don't have time. I don't want to negotiate some of these issues. I got a lot of, you know, fancy optional criteria, and I don't know, you guys can't represent them, never mind. So RCKMS is a knowledge repository from that aspect of the project. Do we make the base content active for every jurisdiction? That's something we've been talking about. I don't know that we've had an answer yet, but it's certainly been something that we've discussed and we need feedback on, because if someone hasn't authored their own jurisdiction-specific criteria, is there just a big blank hole, or do we essentially put in the base criteria as serving for them? And if we do, they're going to miss their jurisdiction-specific reportables, obviously, anything that's not nationally notifiable, and they'll also not be able to customize their criteria. From the standpoint of RCKMS as a centralized decision support service for the nation, what we expect to be doing even if we do that first part and say, all right, default criteria is active for jurisdiction X because they haven't put in their own jurisdiction-specific criterion. So an EISR comes in, it is potentially reportable to jurisdiction X because it meets the default criteria, but we don't know anything about, we don't know whether jurisdiction X can get it, can accept EICRs or anything. So what would have to go back as a reportability response would be, yeah, this is reportable, but you got to do it another way because this automated platform isn't going to do it for you. So I think there's a lot of more thinking to do about the implications here. I mean, we're just sort of dipping our toes into this water, and that's why we're having this conversation today. So for me, the bottom line is, yeah, the time really is now, or at least really soon. You heard Janet talking about making training available for everybody later this year. There's a lot of things to consider. I adore what we're doing, and I love the work that the content development team has put together, and you know, I think this is a huge step forward for us as a public health community. But it's not perfect, and it's certainly not done. And so the bottom line for me is that, you know, this is a collaborative effort the way it has been all along, and so we're wanting to work with you to make this a reality. So thank you.